Today on The Grave Talks, Growing Out of Possession, a conversation with David Pierce Rodriguez. As a child, David Pierce Rodriguez spent several of his formative years possessed, living in a mansion that held its own spirit, combined with depressing family trauma, likely led to something very dark taking on David's body and actions. All these years later, David is out to help those affected by the paranormal and those affected by the supernatural world's darkest sex, the demonic.
So I was 12, and he appeared in a chair when I was getting ready to go to sleep. I just got into the bed, felt like something was in the room, look across, and my grandfather's right there sitting in a chair. Didn't say anything, just kind of nodded his head, kind of like to say, I guess, you know, what I imagined he was saying was that I'm going to be okay. And that was it. He just kind of disappeared. It was it. It was very strange, very fast. And that's the first time. And then after that, we'll go up a couple of years in the same house from 1984 to 1986. From ages of 14 to 16, I underwent a possession in that house. So kind of have a probably maybe a different story than most people do.
Yeah.
But that got pretty intense. And then I tried to forget about it. After that, I moved out of that house, moved, went to high school and, you know, moved around a bunch of times, and I wasn't in Ohio anymore. So that stuff didn't really happen to me anymore. And I kind of wanted to forget about it. But as I got older, in my 20s and stuff, stuff kept happening. I would see stuff around me happening that was kind of paranormal, had the question still, and it's always in the back of my head. But I didn't really have time to kind of pursue that in my 20s and until my early 30s. And then in late 2003, early 2004, what about 17 years ago? That's a long time ago. 17 years ago?
It's crazy.
It was in Nebraska. I started Prism Paranormal. So it was my first Prism team. We started there in Nebraska. And that went really well. I mean, I was trying to join a team. I had never, looked for ghosts on my own. I had an experience where I owned a recording studio and got an EVP on there. And so that kind of really intrigued me. So I wanted to work on audio stuff. Mm-hmm. And finally got some people around me that we were doing good stuff. But we actually got a lot of people in Nebraska would call us to come to their houses. We had even, we had one city in Nebraska call us to go to their cemetery. We ended up doing the Villiscax murder house, one of the first people to go into the Villiscax murder house. And a bunch of places there where it was good. We did a lot of TV and stuff over there, like local TV and local news and stuff. And
sure.
That team's still going strong, still investigating the same places we investigated way back when. But then I ended up moving. I got divorced and moved to South Florida, to Miami. And that was 8 years ago. And so what I did is I started a Prism team in South Florida. And now I kind of just investigate the stuff down here. I mean, I do go on trips and stuff, and I do investigate stuff up north when I go travel. But it's pretty much I do all Miami, a little bit of Broward, sometimes mm-hmm. the Keys. I do all the stuff down here, which people don't really know about because people don't really associate Miami as a haunted place, but there are places down here.
Sure. Lots to unpack there. I'm going to go way back to the beginning of what you were talking about, and then we'll kind of just slowly weave our way forward. When you saw your grandfather a few days after his death, when you were 12 years old, in your house, and you wake up, he's sitting there. You know he's dead, but he's there. What's going through little David's mind at that moment in time? How are you processing that?
Well, at this point, I had gone to go. My parents were divorced. They got divorced earlier that year, or maybe the year before. And I was visiting my dad. And so when my grandfather died, I was living in his house, and I was super close to him. And when he died, I heard about it on the phone, and I wasn't there, and I just felt really awful that I should have been there. So mm-hmm. what I did is immediately just flew back that night, went to the funeral, a day or two later, and then it was just after the funeral that he'd showed up there. But it was like, I think that he was just there to say that it's okay. And it was going on my mind. I was never like, I've never been a person to be scared of anything like that. I mean, even from the beginning, anytime I had any kind of spirit trying to communicate with me, and that house was crazy with the kind of spirit communication, but it just, to me, it was more interesting. And I just kind of looked at them as like people that are alive in a way. I mean, it just, to me, it's more interesting. And I just kind of want to talk to them as much as possible and not, I don't, it doesn't freak me out whatsoever, really. I mean, there are some scary places I've gone to. I mean, you know, we all know that who are in this business, but there's not ghosts in per se. It doesn't faze me, except that I just want to communicate more and more.
Up until that point, what was your outlook on ghosts? I mean, did you believe that they existed? Did you have much thought at all into it at 12 years old? Or I mean, it's quite a sight to see, to have something like that happen. So I'm trying to get an idea from you of the fact that you said you just, you know, you were interested. A lot of kids would be kind of freaked out or have it not as calm, I guess, of a reaction as you did. So I'm trying to understand where you were mentally to be able to have that reaction.
I think it was because I just came back from a funeral. I would think it was maybe my whole, I was sad that day. And so I just really wanted to see him. So like, I think that was my wish. So there was no reason to be like, you know, freaking out about it. Like, it was just, I don't know. And you know, it's very rare to see an apparition. I mean, yeah. I've seen probably three in my life, and you know, sometimes you wonder, is that a real person? Was it a thing or not? But I have never seen anything like that when I was that age, sitting there looking at someone mm-hmm. in a chair showing up to me like that. Like, that has never happened again. So I even questioned it myself, but I'm positive what I saw. And I wasn't asleep yet. I hadn't, you know, I mean, I literally just got out of the bed, turned off the lights, and I felt like somebody was in the room, like I was playing hide and go seek with somebody. And they had just walked in the room and I was hiding in a closet. I just, you know, all, you know, it was probably static electricity or whatever's going on in that room, but my arm hairs were up and I was like, you know, I totally looked towards that chair and he was there. But that house, there's a lot more stories that go on in that house in the following few years. And what I didn't know is that house was just supercharged. I mean, it was built by, it's a 14 level house, a mansion, and it is, it's built next to an Indian burial ground, a Native American burial ground. It a creek runs behind it. There's just a lot of the, mm-hmm. a lot of stuff is going on in that land, and I don't know what exactly. I mean, there was a lot of, like, there was a rape there. The day I moved, the police were all moved into that house. That week, a girl had been raped down at the bottom of the property, and it was sitting on acres. So, mm-hmm. but at the bottom of the property where the dividing line was, and you know, they came to me even seeing if I was, you know, one of the, you know, they had to go to everybody around to see if, but it was a kid with a red bike. I didn't have a red bike. I just moved there. I was with my family. I was too young. They ended up finding the guy, and it was some guy who was, you know, later 20s that he raped her, killed her, and this girl. But there's just that whole land had this just, I don't know. It was charged, I guess you could say.
I mean, to have that, like, the first day you move in, and by the way, down at the edge of the property there, the police are investigating a rape and murder. It's not exactly the housewarming that anybody, you know, wants. After you had that experience with your grandfather, you saw him in your bedroom. Did you share that information? Did you share that story with any family or friends at that time?
Absolutely. And I did for a few years there with my whole family. I mean, my dad wasn't living there, but my mom was. My grandfather was there with Alzheimer's, so he had a nanny 24 hours a day. And as that happened, more stuff started happening. It was more ghost stuff in the beginning. It was more like trying to get my attention. And little things, like I would be walking in the dark, put my hand somewhere and something would touch it. And then I'd be like, what's that? You know, and that would kind of catch you off guard. And so I started asking like the nannies and people who worked there around the house, because I mean, it was constantly being cleaned. It's a huge house. So there was constantly people there in and out. And I would ask them, you know, what have you seen? And they would tell me over the years that my grandfather, my grandmother used to own what was called, this is in Columbus, Ohio, and they used to own the Miles Drive-Ins, and it was about 16 drive-in theaters. So that was his, like, the main office, and they would have people in and out, not while I was alive there at that time, but, you know, prior. So that would be back in the 60s and stuff going on. So they had 40s, 50s, and 60s. They had a bunch of people in there, kind of, you know, it was just, so there's, there was still a lot of people coming in and out just because it was a big house. But I would ask the people who had been there back in the past, like, what was going on in this house, if they had any experiences, similar experiences. My mom had a couple, but, you know, she, I don't think anything really happened to her. But some of the people who had worked there had seen ghosts. They had felt stuff touch them, and they had little stories. Some of the nannies or the nurses that were working for my grandfather, they had had some experiences. Just weird things would happen. There's a list of stories, but
sure. And I want to get into all that. I'm just curious as to how the family, you know, it sounds like, were they accepting of this story of you saying, hey, I saw grandpa? Were they believing you, or was it like, oh, you know, you're just going through a tough time? Because I'm wondering if
it was anyone... more like, sure, kid.
Okay.
type of stuff.
What I'm wondering is, and maybe this is something that happened later, if at all, just because so frequently we hear these stories of when you're a child, someone close to you passes, you have that visitation in the night. And then oftentimes the child never talks about it, or it's just kind of brushed off. But then 20 years later, people are like, yeah, he visited us too. and it's quite a thing where it's like, had we all known this all these years ago, was there anything like that went on with you or any other family member? Did he, to your knowledge, did he visit anyone else after his passing?
So with my family, they basically are all there. They were all, not so much now, but back in the day, my brother's house, he just called me the other day, and he moved into a new house in upstate New York, and it's haunted. So anyway, but back then, you know, now if they hear a story about ghosts, they come to me.
Yeah.
But back then it was kind of like, they didn't really have time for that type of thing. They didn't really, nothing. And it's interesting. Why do ghosts, are they attracted to certain people and not others? But they really didn't. They didn't believe in it. Didn't want to believe in it. There was a time in 1985, early 1986, where at that time I was like going through the kind of like the end of my possession, and I was super like I could feel the house. Let's say by this point, like the house, you know, me and the house kind of like I felt like one with the house, and I don't know how to explain it, but we were downstairs with the maid who was watching us. My mom was out, and she was also like the nanny. She was taking care of us and taking care of my grandfather. And all of a sudden we're watching TV, and I was like, I could feel something was going to happen, kind of that spidey sense, like something bad was going to happen. And this was kind of like, we were downstairs in the basement, which was kind of like the epicenter of all the activity. And so we're sitting down. I'm like, something bad's going to happen. Something really bad's going to happen. And I could just feel like, shut up, David. What are you talking about? We're watching a movie. And then all of a sudden at the bar, there was a bar on the other end of that floor in the basement area. You hear a bottle smash to the ground. So she's freaked out because she believed in ghosts. She had some stuff happen, or the woman taking care of my grandfather. So she rushes us all up to my grandfather's room, a couple levels up, and we locked the door. He had like a super safe door there in case somebody came to rob, and like secret compartments in the walls and stuff like that. It was a crazy house. But I was like amazed, that house. And then we call the cops, and the cops come, and there was absolutely no bottle, no glass, no anything. And I was like, I told you guys, this stuff's real, you know, nobody wanted to believe me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess there were certain scenarios and certain instances of where people would be like, oh, but then even after that happens, they're like, oh, well, you know, could it be something else? I mean, what else could it be? I mean, we're right there. A bottle smashes to the floor in the same room. You know, it's like, but it is what it is.
Sure. It's one of those things, you know, it happened, you know, you heard what you heard. There's no, it was this or writing it off as something else. But if it's not, you can't find it. You can't find it.
But you know, actually, that started me, I think, probably for about 20 years trying to prove it to other people, which then I gave up on, you know.
Sure. Once,
then I just like, well, there's no point in that anymore. It's just because we can't really even garner evidence if we're just paying attention to, you know, to please the people that are skeptical, because they're never going to believe. So,
yeah, that's very true. I think we've worked our way to this point, and this is, I'm very interested to hear. You said from about 84 to about 86, you were possessed in this house. Lead us up to the beginning of your possession. How did things get to the point of where you believed that you were possessed? And then let's talk about what that experience was like.
Okay, so this story, just in general, I try not to talk too much about it, because I know people are, even in this business, it's, you know, you could say a house has a demon or this, and you're like, yeah, whatever, you know, you're watching Ghost Adventures or whatever. It's like, basically, everyone is like, you don't run into too many possession cases. I'm actually dealing with one right now down in Homestead, Florida, kind of like an oppression type of case, but it just doesn't happen that often.
Sure.
I mean, literally, in all the time I've been doing this, three cases I've had, you know, and one of them was major, maybe two were major. The other one, you get, you know, but it's like, it just doesn't happen. Most of the cases, so you're just going to a house and people are scared of noises. So, what happened to me, I mean, I guess we'll get to the first thing that happened to me is I was in the bathroom. My brother and our nanny were going out to go eat. They took off. I went up to the bathroom. And I heard a knock on the door. This is the top floor, like this, I guess the 14th level, whatever it is. And knock on the door. And I'm like, I'm in the bathroom. I thought my brother came back. And I said, I'm in the bathroom. Leave me alone. And then I get another knock. I'm like, Jeff, stop. And then then another really boom, 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 a big knock on the door. And then a rattle on the doorknob. I'm like, Jeff, already, come on, you know.
Yeah.
So I go there. I thought it was my brother. I go out. I run to the door. I open it, and there's absolutely nobody there. These guys come back about 25 minutes later. I'm like, and I tell them about it. I was like, you guys sure that wasn't you? Like, oh, no, they came back with burgers and stuff. I'm like, that was the weirdest thing. I had all this knocking. And then the nanny told me that she had been there a long time ago. She was actually friends with my mom. My nanny's mom at that time, my nanny's mom was my mom's nanny, if that makes any sense.
Okay, wow, yeah, okay.
So she had grown up in that house as well, and she started telling me the stories of – I started getting into more detective work and more trying to communicate with what was going on there. She'd tell me the stuff that happened to her and the touches and the things that she had seen and hearing people walk up and down the steps at night and this type of thing. And – well, then I started getting more interested in it, especially after it started to communicate with me. Well, then it started, like I'd say, I'd be in walking around in the dark, try to turn a light on. I'd get something touch my hand. That would happen occasionally. When I was alone at the house, I would start hearing a series of three knocks. And then in the beginning, I was like, well, you know, what do I do about that? But I'd say after a couple of weeks, when this kept happening, I started knocking back, and I think probably that's when things took a turn.
Mm-hmm.
I started knocking back, and then it would knock back. It was kind of like a little game. Then I went into, you know, I graduated to the Ouija board. Sorry, everyone, but I graduated into that. I was doing that by myself, and a lot of crazy things happened after. And then that opened the portal, I guess. But I wouldn't say the Ouija board per se is what did it. I would say it was me trying to communicate is what did it. And as we all know, if you want to communicate with ghosts, be ready for what comes. But that's how it started.
So essentially, your curiosity and your investigating, you know, at the time as a child, your thoughts are it essentially opens something up. It, you said, I'm interested, and you're trying to almost make two-way communication with this, not knowing the dangers of what could possibly transpire by doing just that. So,
exactly.
So you get to the point where you started using the Ouija board, and you said that's really kind of where you think the portal kind of opened up, or, you know, things just got so heated that we almost get to a tipping point of, and now we're going from beyond these things are out there and you're sensing them to they're possession, obviously, they're taking on you. You are taking on them, and they're interacting with you and working through you. What began to happen? What was the possession like for you? Give some insight.
Right. So
into
then
that.
it changed after that, where like I started to have an affinity with, I thought it was male, like a he type of thing, but I don't really know what, you know, the name, or I didn't study demonology or anything at the time. I didn't have any idea what, you know, I was just basically talking to whatever was knocking on the wall. So, but basically after I got this affinity to it, the house had lived there a little bit longer, had communicated with it for months. Then it just, I'd come home, like, and this is the thing about a possession too. It wouldn't affect me while I was at school so much or anything like that. It would be when I came back at home, and especially when I was alone. And basically I'd come home, I just start like staring in a mirror and like thinking about it and talking to it in my head, and maybe even vocalizing, talking and to it. And then my eyes would change black underneath. I mean, it's really hard. Like, I know people probably don't even believe it. It's even hard to even talk about it, because sure. I know people be like, oh yeah, sure, whatever, David.
Well, yeah.
But there was a physical change that would occur, and then I would just basically go out and look to go piss people off, you know, in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got bad where, you know, one time I was like running after my brother with a knife, and you know, and it basically in my head, what I thought that it really wanted towards the end. In the beginning, it was just kind of whatever. But towards the end, I think it really wanted me to either kill myself or kill someone in my family or kill someone in the house, or that's where it was leading to. And
yeah.
But luckily, my parents, since they were divorced at 16, I was able to move with my dad. So I moved out of the house and I moved to Washington, D.C., and that was the end of that story, really. There's things that have carried on. Here's the strange part about this story.
Yeah.
That is unbelievable in a way. But what I could do at the time during this, it would give me when I had this affinity towards it in that house, I could like affect certain things. More telepathic. I could actually make things move with my mind to a degree, not hugely, but when I get angry. And this still actually has stuck with me, but not as much as back then. And also TVs have changed, but TVs will flash on and off and or change channels or turn off and turn back on. And lights are affected when I get angry and stuff. So, I mean, I don't know if that stuff kind of like sticks with you or if I've opened up something, you know, like I guess people would do with meditation or something. But definitely it's not like when I was a kid, definitely not that type of energy, but it's – that kind of stuff will linger with you in a way.
Sure. I mean, it, when you were going through this and you were, you know, almost having, you know, those fits of rage and things of that nature, my question was going to be, did your family notice a change in you? I would assume they noticed a change in you, and one's being chased by a knife and you holding it. But beyond, you know, those real obvious, you know, this is uncharacteristic moments. Was there other changes that they can point out, or that they pointed out at the time or retrospectively pointed out of like, yeah, this really was different with you during that window of time?
Well, there was, I mean, I never really did anything. My mom was hardly ever there. So we were really, our nanny was there all the time. And my poor nanny, I don't even know why I was going after her, because she was just the nicest thing ever. But there was this one occasion when I was just super angry at my brother. She had stopped me from wanting to beat him up or something. And I'm not a bad person, by the way. This is just this went on for 2 years. Okay. But, and I was going, you know, my parents are going through divorce. Like, I was like the right host for this type of,
sure.
A thing. My brother's a little too young still, and I don't know. I was just like, I was perfect for the picket for this thing. And she had like put me in some kind of timeout or something, and I was just so angry. And this is another unbelievable story, but I was just so angry at her. She had to collect the laundry from downstairs in the laundry room, which is the basement, like this portal to this thing. And she goes down there and I'm like, you're going to burn, you know, I can't believe you're doing it. You're going to burn. And she goes to touch the iron, which isn't even plugged in. She touches the iron and burns her hand. Literally, and then she pulls up the cord. She goes, it's not even plugged in. And I just start laughing. Ah, ha, ha, ha. Because, I mean, that's what, you know, I don't know if that was me, if that's a thing. And that happened. So.
Sure.
You know, some people will believe, but that stuff has to happen to them first.
Well, sure. I mean, I believe you. I mean, this is, you know, we talk about these things all the time. So that's, we're not here on our program to ever be like, let's debunk this or that. It's just, let's take people at their word and hear their stories and ask questions.
But even hearing it back myself, just like, I try to judge myself. Like, you know, I mean, I was 14 years old when that happened. So, sure. I mean, you have to think, what is that going through a kid's mind? And I don't know.
Well,
but
I'm sure you had a lot of people throw at you, well, you know, he's acting out because the parents are going through a divorce. But there's obviously something. This went beyond just your normal acting out. This, you know, when you look back on this and you can remember these moments of the iron of the knife and things of that nature. Do you have memory of doing these things, or are these things that?
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. My brother remembers that stuff too. And you know, the nanny remembers, yeah. I mean, yeah, it happened.
Well, what I'm wondering is, has it been reiterated to you, or was it kind of one of those almost blackout type things where I have no memory of doing these sort of things, but everyone else does?
No, I would remember.
Okay.
I remember what I was doing. I just couldn't, the next day I'd be like, well, why did you do that? That's ridiculous. But
sure.
You know, and the thing is too, with possession, like there's no possession case that goes on without somebody being super troubled, you know?
Of course.
You have to be, even with adults, they're usually taking drugs or drinking and, you know, they can't deal with it. So, you know, the possession case I was working on in Nebraska, she had to be tied up to the bed at night because she tried to kill her husband and tried to kill herself. So it's like her husband would tie her up. It wasn't us. I don't think I did that. But her husband, she, on her own accord, would tie her. You know, I mean, that the church tried to help her. That didn't really work out so well. And they ended up moving. And anyway, but everyone who goes through a possession, kids or adults or whatnot, and it's mainly the kids, but they are troubled.
Sure. When you you went through all of this and these dramatic personality shifts, you said around 86 it seemed to kind of subside. That my understanding correctly in the timeline, that's around the time that you did in fact move.
Yeah, I moved, and that's when it stopped. And I think a lot of it wouldn't just be the location move, which probably was the most important thing there, mm-hmm. the location move of it for the reason it stopped, but it was also a shift in, I finally got to go and move back with my dad. I'd felt like, you know, that's what I was angry about, you know, that my mom took me away from my dad and I missed him. I hadn't seen him in like really 4 years. And, you know, I moved on my birthday, never came back. I'm like, oh, I'm going to go visit. And I never came back. I'm like, you can keep my clothes. I'm just going to move here. So, you know, it was a chapter change for me. So that probably helped a lot. Moved into an apartment building. You're not going to see too many possessed people in apartment buildings. And it was good. I mean, that house is – I've been back to that house too. It's like it calls me, that house, in a way. You know, people live there, so I can't obviously go visit now like I would want to. But, mm-hmm. That house is it's interesting.
Still standing, still there, and still calling to you in a way. When you got out of that situation and it was a new situation, new kind of path for you in life, how was it when you looked back on those previous years of your mindset? And obviously, there's going to be a lot of things that are going to change just naturally and normally that do not involve possession, just because it's a whole new life that you kind of embarked upon. How did you distinguish between what was changing that would be natural changes and what were things that had changed that were because of the possession and the house and everything that was really going after you on top of everything else that was understandably emotionally traumatizing at the time with what was going on with your family?
I don't know if I totally understand the question.
How do you differentiate the two? From reality, from the things everyone else can see and put a stamp on and say, this is natural, this is normal, this is what everyone would be going through who's having this experience, versus this is supernatural. These are things that were not just because of the situation that you were going through? How did you recognize the difference in the two when you looked back on those years?
Like I said before, it's kind of hard to tell through the age of a 14-year-old eyes, and especially when it's yourself. You know, it's hard to read yourself. You know, it's easier to take a case and go, oh, this is true, this is not true, this is, you know, she's lying about this, not lying about that. But that's why basically the things, most of the stuff that I take from what happened for those 2.5 years, mm-hmm. 2 years, is the bigger things that people witnessed along with me, because all the other stuff, you know, it is what it is and nobody's there. And, you know, how can I prove that I could move a cup across? I didn't film it. So, yeah. And then still people would say I had a string on it, or it just, you know, what I did is I learned a lot for if I, and not that I've ever done that many possession cases, but if I learned a lot about possession in itself, being the person who was possessed too, and I can sympathize and empathize with those people, I think, a little bit more with people going through that, because usually people think they're just, you know, effed up people, and they, you know, a lot of it's probably hogwash, and they're not, you know, they're doing their own voice change and they're putting mascara under their eyes, but that's not true. You know, I mean, there are true possession cases. So
that wraps up the first part of our conversation with David Pierce Rodriguez about growing out of possession. In part two, we'll ask, what does David think was behind the darkness in his childhood home where he found himself possessed? What drove David back into the paranormal investigative world on a more serious level? And when David began investigating the paranormal with his new team, what was he hoping to accomplish? Also, did he have any reservations about getting into that world, considering his own personal possession experiences as a child? And what led David to get involved with someone else who was possessed? All those questions and more in part two of our conversation. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.